Welcome to the podcast of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, a weekly show on media from WILL Radio. Visit us at will.uiuc.edu.
You say live on WILL AM 580 in a beautiful summer day from Urbana, Illinois. Today we have as our guest a highly acclaimed and decorated international journalist, John Pilger, joining us live on the phone as he makes his tour across the United States. So join us today for what should be an extraordinary hour of discussion of media and politics around the world. But first, before we go to John Pilger, please let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
A landmark study of radio ownership in the United States published by Free Press makes a compelling case for more media diversity. Off the Dial meticulously analyzed the ownership and control of every radio station in America and found that less than one out of every eight stations is owned by women or people of color. You can find women-owned stations in just 40% of all local radio markets and minority-owned stations in just about half. What's worse, female and non-white-owned radio stations are more likely to be independent and more likely to provide diversity in programming. It was independent stations just like these that were decimated in the wave of consolidation that swept through the radio industry following the passage of the Telecommunications Act of 1996, meaning this problem has accelerated over the last 10 years and current media policies are only making it worse. This has FCC Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein gravely concerned.
What we see here, the study is extremely alarming. Minorities and women have been left off the dial because the FCC has pursued policies that are far off the mark.
Commissioner Michael Copps calls it, quote, a national disgrace.
It's not that they're riding in the back of the bus when it comes to media ownership. They're not even on the bus.
What's more, according to Brent Wilkes, the executive director of the League of United Latin American Citizens, is that the homogenization of programming by mostly white male station owners is detrimentally skewing debate on the important political questions of our time, such as immigration.
The lack of diversity, the lack of local content, actually is moving the policy debate in an anti-minority, anti-women agenda because the real people out there in the communities don't have access to the airwaves, and the local minority is getting that access because the owners of these stations provide that to them.
Mark Lloyd with the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights says examination of radio diversity is long overdue and our public officials owe us more.
In 1996, Congress required the FCC to study the problems of ownership in small businesses and minorities and women in the media industry. The FCC has not done this study.
Changing the radio ownership landscape in favor of creating more diversity at the local level may go a long way toward diversifying content on the dial, though hip-hop historian and journalist Davey D says simply changing the gender and color of those at the top of the currently conglomerated radio industry will not solve the problem of women and minorities being stereotyped and misrepresented in the media.
In a station like Radio 1, which is often lauded because Kathy Hughes is a black woman who owns a lot of stations, yet she has a lot of complaints when we have our meetings around media because she's just as bad as the Clear Channels.
How can this problem be addressed? The FCC could promulgate new rules to encourage more local ownership among radio stations, and Congress could re-implement tax incentives for larger broadcasters to sell off stations to the underrepresented, or re-establish national caps on how many stations a single company can own. Gloria Steinem, founder of Ms. Magazine and co-founder of Greenstone Media, a talk radio network wholly focused on women, says this new research may help push a fix to the fore.
It has become bad enough so that it has to get better. It has nowhere to go downward.
To learn more about the state of radio ownership involving women and people of color, you can read the full report at www.stopbigmedia.com and click on the front page link Off the Dial.
Is the Corporation for Public Broadcasting on another hunt for objectivity? CPB CEO Patricia Harrison says she's tried hard to undo the damage done by a former partisan plant, which used to hold her job. That was Kenneth Tomlinson, best known for going on a witch hunt against so-called liberal bias in public broadcast programming, conduct which brought the ire of the CPB's own Inspector General and Congress and resulted in him stepping away from the CPB under a cloud of disgrace. Although Patricia Harrison herself used to chair the Republican National Committee, she's gained the respect of many NPR and PBS member stations by making public broadcasting funding and management more transparent. Now she's asking the deans of 9 journalism schools to help define what the words objectivity and balance mean in the context of public broadcasting. However, Harrison admits the CPB does not have the power to impose such standards on public radio and TV programming, nor does she have an agenda of her own.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, we're privileged to have as our guest one of the more decorated journalists of the past generation or two, someone active in the profession in Britain and Australia and really around the world now for some 5 decades. Joining us from Los Angeles, where he's in the middle of a tour and where he'll be speaking for a night, we're privileged to have with us John Pilger. John, are you there?
I am, yes, Bob. It's very good to talk to you, too.
Well, I should say that you do have a new film out, a documentary, The War on Democracy, and a relatively new book, Freedom Next Time, both of which are available, and I urge people to look at them. In your career, as I was going through your dossier, you worked for the Daily Mirror, as I get it, for nearly a quarter century as a correspondent?
That's right, yes. When I first went to London from Australia in the 60s, I was fortunate enough to get a job on a newspaper that had 2 distinctions. It was a serious tabloid, and it was then the biggest circulating newspaper in the non-Chinese world, around the world. And the combination of those two gave me opportunities to report the world to a wider audience.
One of the stories you did cover and you've written about was the wars in Indochina in the 60s and 70s. Were you in Vietnam and Cambodia during that period?
Yes, I was. I first went to Vietnam in 1966 when, the war was it was still building. It was very intense, but building. And I left Vietnam on one of the helicopters from the U.S. Embassy on April the 29th, 1975.
When you're in America, what do you think, from your experience, most Americans have wrong about the U.S. experience of Vietnam? What do they not quite understand from what you saw when you were there?
I think understanding that that it wasn't a mistake. It wasn't a well-intentioned blunder. That it was a very deliberate act. It was part of a very deliberate strategy to really get rid of the regime of Ho Chi Minh in Vietnam and establish a U.S. bridgehead in that part of the world. I mean, the overall strategic aim was based on a typically paranoid Cold War concern about Japan to the north. The two pillars of American interests in Asia, Japan to the north and Indonesia to the south. Neither of those concerns were justified, of course, and 2 to 3 million people died as a result. Having said that, I find that there are two Americas, there are two United States. I think people understand a lot more than their media does, and you've written very considerably and in a very distinguished way about the media and helping Americans understand that. I think there is a critical public intelligence in all countries, and in this country it exists too. I'm not sure that there are many people in the United States now who, those who have any real knowledge of Vietnam, who consider it other than a total disaster for their country and for the Vietnamese. There's been a lot of revisionism, as you know, and the Reaganite notion of a noble cause, a well-intentioned noble cause, exists in academic circles, but I'm not sure it does among the public.
Our guest today on Media Matters is John Pilger, the noted journalist and filmmaker, and he is in Los Angeles today as part of a North American tour. One of your new film, John Pilger, is titled The War on Democracy. What is the War on Democracy?
Well, the War on Democracy, I mean, it turns around the very notion of the war on terror. I remember looking at a live broadcast of President Bush's re-inauguration address, in which he mentioned the words liberty and democracy. I think I counted about 28 times. And really, this was a marvelous inversion of the truth, because in an Orwellian sense, the very opposite was true. And here we still have Bush at the G8 meeting talking about bringing democracy to various parts of the world. In fact, what the Bush administration has done, and administrations before his have done, is bring a war on democracy to much of the world, and especially to the area of the world that my film concentrates on, and that is Latin America, known, as you know, contemptuously as the backyard. And there has been a war on democracy by various United States administrations, since the 19th century, but certainly intensified through the latter part of the 20th century. And now that there's yet again another response to that, where people are trying to take control of their own lives in Latin America, the war on democracy continues in terms of propaganda. It's not the usual invasive war where the Marines are sent in to reestablish a government to the liking of Washington. At the moment, it's very much a propaganda war against the movements of democracy in that part of the world.
Our guest, John Pilger. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment, the phone number here at Media Matters is 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. John Pilger, noted journalist and filmmaker who has the new film War on Democracy out, also the author of several books, including the most recent book, Freedom Next Time. So please call in. We can talk about a whole range of issues with John Pilger, including Iran, the Middle East, Asia, and as we're talking about right now, Latin America. There have been dramatic changes, John Pilger, in the political landscape in Latin America in the past decade, which you know as well as anyone. And in particular, the Venezuelan regime under Hugo Chavez has earned the ire of Washington. What is your assessment of the Chavez regime, which is oftentimes presented in the United States as being a real threat to democracy in the region?
Well, again, you invert that threat to democracy. The threat that the Venezuelan government represents, like the Bolivian government and the Ecuadorian government, but mainly the Venezuelan government, because Venezuela is a major supplier of oil to the United States. The threat is in principle the same one that the reforming Sandinista government of Nicaragua presented to the United States in the 1980s before it was crushed, and that is of an example, a model, or as they would say in Washington, perhaps even a virus that might spread. But for the majority of people, certainly in Venezuela, it's a virus of freedom. I've spent some time there in the barrios around Caracas and elsewhere filming, and there's no doubt that the government of Chavez is nothing if it's not a people's government. It comes from a grassroots movement that is very typically Latin American. Something very similar has happened in other countries, from Bolivia down to Argentina. But in Venezuela, it has managed to coalesce into a movement that has produced a government which has had the good fortune to have a very clever politician, a very charismatic politician, representing it. But Chavez represents that movement. It's not his regime. It's not even a regime. Usually regime is a sort of pejorative term. It's a government that has been elected so many times. I think it's a world record. And unlike the United States and unlike Britain, it's elected by a very considerable majority and a very high turnout of people. The difference in Latin America is that these are very polarized societies between a rich and vociferous and powerful minority and the poor majority. My impression of Venezuela when I first saw it was that it was not unlike South Africa under apartheid, that the minority had for a long time, the white minority, and there is an issue of race here, a white minority had run Venezuela for a very long time, and had been backed by the United States. Well, now Venezuela is run by a government that represents the majority, and this historically always upsets administrations in Washington.
Recent weeks, especially in the past, say, 10 days or so, the U.S. news media, and you've been in the country, you've probably seen some of this, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, much of our broadcast media has had repeated coverage of the lack of renewal of the television license for RCTV in Venezuela. And this has generally been framed, in fact, I think I can safely say without exception, as a dire attack upon freedom of the press, freedom of speech, and democratic liberties in Venezuela. And I'd be interested to get your assessment of that. And when you're answering that, because of your own particular experience covering the world, if you could sort of discuss Venezuela's state of freedom of the press in comparison to other nations in the world today.
Well, the New York Times and the Washington Post and the big network companies would say that, wouldn't they? Pot calling the kettle black. The United States has one of the most unfree medias in the world. That may seem an extraordinary statement to some of your listeners, but I've lived and worked here for on and off for quite some time, and I think I learned pretty quickly that although there's a lot of media, it pretty well says the same thing over and over again, and the very notion of freedom of speech is actually so distorted here because it's really the freedom of large corporations to own the media and put out the message that they want to. That's what freedom of speech means. It's a bit like Bush talking about democracy and freedom. It means pretty well almost the opposite. Venezuela is interesting because it was like not unlike the United States before the popular movements brought Chavez to power in that, yes, free newspapers and free broadcasting institutions like RCTV, which recently didn't have its license renewed, these regarded themselves as free institutions and exemplifying freedom of the press. But what they exemplified, as in this country, was the power and the right of media moguls to manipulate and control the media as they wished. Freedom of speech, which, when the New York Times talks about it, is really a version of the New York of institutional freedom. It doesn't include the majority of the people in Venezuela. I mean, it's interesting in Venezuela what has happened since RCTV had its license withdrawn. There has been a flowering of community radio stations, the media, that represents the majority of the people. Again, it's representing the majority of the people, whereas RCTV and the majority of the press in Venezuela represented a white, well-off minority, and still does. I mean, Venezuela, I've never been in a country, I think this is fair to say, I don't think I've been in a country where you turn on the television, most television channels, or you turn on the radio, and you pick up a newspaper, and most of them are implacably, abusively opposed to the government. This is a country that is apparently lacking freedom of speech. Not long ago, they had one of the tabloids in Caracas had pictures of dictators with babies. They had a picture of Stalin with a baby, a picture of Hitler with a baby, and they had a picture of Chavez with a baby. And the logic of this was that Chavez had to be a fascist like the other two, as they called it, because they all love babies. I mean, that just seems so absurd. It's almost difficult to think about. But that is the level of abuse combined with pictures of Chavez dressed as Hitler on the front page that is leveled at the government day after day. I think the campaign in this country, the media campaign, has been very interesting against Venezuela, because I think the media in the United States plays a role of preparing situations for either invasion or some kind of action by the administration. We saw it in Iraq. We're seeing it in Iran. I pick up the Los Angeles Times this morning, and there on the front page is no doubt an entirely credible story about how, well, I'm not sure it's entirely credible, actually, but it's interesting, about how there is increased repression inside Iran. It's actually written from Cairo. But unquestionably, it's part of a preparation, the kind of preparation that Gordon in the New York Times has been writing now for quite some time about Iran's nuclear ambitions. But going back to Venezuela, the attacks on Venezuela are because Venezuela has become, to a large degree, not entirely, an independent country. That's why it is being attacked. That's intolerable. That there can be a truly independent country, especially within the hemisphere.
Our guest today on Media Matters is John Pilger, the documented journalist and filmmaker with in the United States, traveling on a speaking tour. He's made the recent film, The War on Democracy, also the author of the recently published book, Freedom Next Time. John Pilger will be in Chicago next weekend, speaking on Saturday at both 11:30 a.m. and 7:30 p.m. at the Crown Plaza, Chicago O'Hare, at a conference I believe called Socialism 2007, if I have my material correct. So those of you in the area who want to hear John Pilger should go to Chicago next Saturday. We have a full bank of callers that, that I'd like to get to right now to speak with John Pilger. Let's go first, if we can, to line one, Champagne.
Hi, I'm interested in 9/11. In 2004, you published an interesting article on the military stand-down on 9/11, and since then there's been more research published, such as by Nafis Ahmed and others. I was wondering at this point, what is your assessment of the official story of what happened in the U.S. on September 11th, 2001, and also your assessment of the 9/11 Commission and the report it produced, having been headed by Philip Zelikow, an insider in the Bush administration?
Thank you, caller.
Well, I think that all commissions like that, and I'm going back to the commission that investigated the assassination of President Kennedy, all these commissions ought to be treated like any government pronouncement. Frankly, even if they do come from within Congress, they should be treated with skepticism. That doesn't mean to say that they're wrong, but there are many inconsistencies in the Commission's report. I think the short answer to what I think your overall question is, I don't know, and I don't think anybody knows, the extent or the detail of the stand down of military forces just prior to 9/11.
John, if I can interrupt for a second. For some of our listeners who might not be familiar with that, could you explain what this is alluding to, the stand down of military forces?
Well, the stand down was that there is evidence, and it did come out in the commission's report, that the U.S. The slow reaction to 9/11 was due to a stand-down of a U.S. Air Force system, which ought to have reacted earlier. And the suggestion is that something of this had the orders for this stand-down had come from areas close to the White House. I don't have any more detail on it. I have to say that I'm very suspicious of a lot of theories around 9/11, and I think yes, it's important to understand exactly what happened, but I don't think there's any real evidence, to put it in a nutshell, hard evidence, apart from pieces in a very incomplete jigsaw puzzle, to suggest that the administration was involved.
Let's go to our next caller right at this point. Line 2, St. Joseph, you're on the air with John Pilger.
Yes, thank you. I would like to know from the guest's expertise how he thinks the incoming White House, our administration, the new administration that we will get, should deal with South America.
Thank you, caller.
Does he have?
Okay. Regard South America as an independent, a continent of independent states, and respect that independence. That's the that really is the answer to your question. The whole imperial notion of controlling events in other countries, of manipulating events in other countries, is something that should be offensive to all Democrats, and that states, independent states, ought to be dealt with with respect to their independence. I can't be more specific than that. Clearly there is a complex arrangement, particularly between Venezuela and the U.S., because Venezuela supplies something like a fifth of the U.S.'s oil. I think if it didn't, they'd be less really concerned with what the government of Chavez is doing. But the wise people, even then, there are actually one or two, extraordinarily, I mean, we're speaking relatively here in the current administration, know that there is only grief awaiting the U.S. if it tries to take aggressive action against countries like Venezuela these days. There's even greater grief awaiting the Venezuelans, of course, but there just simply ought to be respect for independence. Simple as that, really.
Well, John, how about those within the administration or within the power structure of the United States who are not really interested, except rhetorically, in democracy or self-government in Latin America, but rather do indeed want to see it be a region of the world that serves interests of them and U.S. firms and investors and U.S. geopolitical interests? How much of a threat to that crowd is the Chavez government in Venezuela as a genuine threat to the status quo?
I think it is a genuine threat to those interests, because and the greatest threat is not, ironically, the way Venezuelan society is being modified. And I do say modified. You know, the Venezuelan economy remains a neoliberal economy with one of the highest growth rates in the world, and the well-off minority there are doing very well. There is no communist regime, not even a socialist regime, being constructed in Venezuela. Certainly, there are very interesting and often inspiring reforms happening within Venezuela. I don't think any of that presents a threat to the interests that you describe. I think what does present a threat to them is the regional coalitions that are now building in Latin America for the first time. And Chavez has played a very positive role in this, of uniting countries that don't altogether agree with each other, such as Lula's government in Brazil. It's quite interesting to see how these leaders like Lula and Kirchner in Argentina and others if at all, criticize each other, because they've started to come together. They've started to talk about continental infrastructure that ought to have been built a long time ago, pipelines and highways and so on and so forth. In other words, the governments of the continent of South America are really standing up for their interests and for the interests of the majority of their people, I believe. Now, that's a threat to the interests you describe, because it will mean that North American control, economic control, and strategic control will weaken.
Our guest is John Pilger, the journalist and filmmaker. The newest film that John Pilger has out, The War on Democracy, and his latest book, Freedom Next Time. John Pilger will be in Chicago next Saturday speaking at the Crown Plaza Chicago here at both 11:30 a.m. and 7:30 p.m. We do have a couple of phone lines open at 333-9455. Let's go now to our toll-free line, Line 4, San Francisco. You're on the air with John Pilger.
Hey, it's an honor to call in. Every time I read any of your essays, Mr. Pilger, I just cheer, because it's a voice that is just absent here in this country pretty much. And I just, I really wanted to call. I have many concerns, but I wanted to call just to ask maybe something personal about your background. I wish you would explain, perhaps, and as I look around and I see how people are carrying on their lives as if there's no war in the world or no poverty here in America, and I know you're from Australia, another more wealthy country. I wonder if you could maybe explain something about what it was in your life that caused you to become indignant about the way things are and how you found empathy for others. That's it.
Well, that's, that's a big question. I think probably two elements there. First of all, I grew up in a family that always regarded its politics as my father used to say, as on the side of the underdog. And that was a very strong influence with me. But I didn't have any really high-blown idea of what I was going to do, and I still don't. I simply wanted to be a journalist, and I believe that journalism is about being, if you like, an agent of people, certainly not of power and governments. I believe that journalism is about not accepting the face value, the received wisdom, the press release view of events. So I don't see any indignation in that. It's almost the way I've always seen being a reporter. And of course, part of that is a respect for humanity. Journalism ought to be a very humane craft because it deals with people's lives. It ought not to be, as Martha Gellhorn, the great reporter, used to say, the view from above. It ought to be the view from the ground.
Our guest, John Pilger. Let's go back to the phone lines again now. Let's go to line 3. Champagne, you're on the air.
Yes, Mr. Pilger, I only came in at about 25 minutes after the hour and heard you, and I thought I might have heard that you said that the freedoms of the press that have been taken away, as our media here in the U.S. has just howled about with what Hugo Chavez did, and I'm very familiar with what the station that just lost its license did in the documentary The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. I thought I had heard you make mention before that in comparison that this is the removal of licenses is not unique just to Hugo Chavez, that there have been other governments, maybe conservative governments around the world, that have just plain kept from renewing station licenses. And I thought I'd heard you say this action took place in Australia with the Howard government. Okay, all right.
You must have heard somebody else. It wasn't me, but I'm quite happy to talk about...
Give me other examples so that if I have to get into
it does. You're quite right. Your premise is correct. It happens all around the world, and it indeed, accountable and democratic governments have a right to regulate the media, have a right to protect children at certain hours of the evening from offensive television. I've been regulated. I make my documentaries mostly for the Independent Television Network, ITV, which is a big commercial network in Britain. I've been regulated to bits, but they still go out. The point is very simple, that the BBC or ITV or CBS or NBC or PBS taken part in, not simply backed, but actually taken part in a coup d'etat against the democratically elected government, which caused the deaths of numbers of people and saw the temporary abolition of all the democratic institutions from the National Assembly through to the Supreme Court. Had that happened, they would have lost their licenses. I think I read, there's a very interesting piece in the Houston Chronicle, they would have lost their license inside 5 minutes. In fact, Chavez waited 5 years to withdraw the license of RCTV. I don't think that was even a particular act of revenge. I think opening up the media in Venezuela to a true diversity of opinion, to real freedom of speech, is a component of the overall program in Venezuela. That doesn't mean to say that there are dangers and pitfalls ahead. Perhaps there are. But it's the very reverse of the way it's been projected in this country. And it is very typical of the double standards that, if I'm to use the term we in the powerful Western world, apply to the rest of the world.
Let's go back to the phone lines if we can. Right now, our guest today on Media Matters, John Pilger, the journalist and filmmaker whose new documentary is The War on Democracy, Addressing Latin America. John Pilger writes on a wide range of political topics, Britain, Australia, the Middle East, Iran, and Iraq. And you can just Google his name, John Pilger, and you'll go to his website and see an archive of his writings. And if you feel like calling in and asking about some of those countries and the politics there, I'm sure he'd welcome such a call. But let's go to the phones again right now to line one, Western Springs. You're on the air with John Pilger.
Hello. I think Hugo Chavez's situation is a major exhibit of why we need independent media. His major sin is that he wants to squeeze corporations for the benefit of his own people to increase spending on education and health care. I am wondering why Human Rights Watch was opposed to his closing or is revoking the license of RCTV?
Well, Human Rights Watch has a very patchy record. It has done some really excellent work in a number of countries. In others, I felt that it has simply represented a consensus, an establishment consensus in the U.S. The same is true from time to time of amnesty in the U.S. None of these human rights organizations are really without their own form, as we say. None of them are perfect by any means. And it often depends on which individual is investigating and presenting the reports. I remember, for instance, some Amnesty report on Nicaragua during the Sandinistas, which I thought was outrageous. Something similar on Cambodia. I can't really answer why they have done that, but I didn't find it particularly surprising.
Let's go to the phone lines again. Now let's go to line two in Urbana. You're on the air with John Pilger.
Yeah, hi, Mr. Pilger. I do a blog called NPR Check, which is sort of takes issue with NPR. I sort of see them fitting into the mainstream media, like you talk about, being basically biased toward government and big business. And I'm just very curious if you've had any interactions with NPR News organization or your opinions of that, and I'll hang up and listen. So thank you.
And John, before you answer that, if I can add and put an addendum to that question, you have written and commented on the BBC, which you've had experience with over the years. So if you could, after discussing NPR, mention your assessment of the BBC, particularly insofar as it's often held up in the United States as the gold standard of public service broadcasting.
Yes, and for that very reason, the BBC is actually expanding its operations in the United States. because there is, I think there is a hunger in this country for media. Your callers, just listening to your callers, they represent that. I'd like to say very quickly, your last caller represents one of the most positive sides of the media in the United States, and that is on the web. There are so many lively websites and bloggers in the United States. Some of them perhaps a little too lively, but many of them actually doing the job that the so-called mainstream says it's doing and are not. Now, in the UK, on the web, there is a wonderful website called medialens.org, and I recommend that your readers have a look at it, because they've kept an eye on the BBC. Their interest is not the Murdoch press and the overtly right-wing press. It's the so-called liberal press. They're not unlike, in some respects, FAIR, which does an excellent job in the United States. But we don't have these monitoring websites, or many of them in the UK, that you have in the US. And it's been very interesting watching the to and fro between the BBC, and which has to reply to criticism, and to watching its replies as probably for the first time it's being deconstructed, its famous objectivity and impartiality and balance is being called into question. The BBC is an extension of the British establishment, and it, I mean, there's one, I'll give you one quick example. There was a study done by the University of Wales, which found that in the build-up to the invasion of Iraq, that in effect most BBC reporting promoted the idea that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and in effect that Bush and Blair were right. That was the sum of BBC reporting. And there are many other examples of that. I've written extensively about the BBC. The BBC is a brilliant organization in terms of its production values and the talent it has. And it's, I would say that its state propaganda, if we can call it that, is more refined than others. But that's what it is.
How about the NPR here in the United States? How familiar with you are with NPR?
Not all that familiar of late, no. So I don't think it would be. I've heard some of it. Some of it doesn't sound a lot different from the rest. But I'm not. I don't think I'm equipped to really comment at this stage. When I've heard some more of it, yes, but not now.
Our guest, John Pilger, a filmmaker, journalist, his new film, The War on Democracy, his new book, Freedom Next Time. He's in the United States on a speaking tour now. We'll be in Chicago Saturday, June 16th, speaking at the Crown Plaza Chicago here at both 11:30 a.m. and at 7:30 p.m. if you're interested in seeing him live and in action. Let's go back to the phone lines yet again, now to line 4. Farina, you're on the air with John Pilger.
Hi. Thanks again for the great, access to this nice radio show. I heard a quote from. Did Reagan actually say, "Don't confuse me with the facts"? I'm almost certain I remember that. And another quote. There's a author and professor, Michael Parenti, and Bob, I'd request you to have him as a guest if you could get him. In one of his speeches, he said. Republicans, the truth is liberal. I thought that was pretty funny. It's like they run this government just on they ride the line of the legal, of what's legal. They ride the line of the law. It's kind of a lawyer way to run a government. It's obfuscation and misdirection. And that the Iraq War isn't a mistake. I liked your comment about the Vietnam War not being a mistake. If you could kind of comment on that in particular. Thanks very much.
Thank you, caller. Yeah, John?
Well, I think what's interesting about, you mentioned the law, I think the law has been politicized. That's what we've seen. The law perhaps always was politicized, but there were certain restraints within that that meant that the law would be upheld, perhaps in the majority of cases. Not anymore, when effectively habeas corpus has been abolished in the United States. The very basic notions that come from the Magna Carta have been thrown out. The idea of kangaroo courts called military commissions should be discussed seriously is absurd. I think that's, you know, when the New York Times and the Washington Post talks about the threat to freedom of speech in Venezuela, the real threats are in this country to basic freedoms that are meant to be protected by constitutional law. The second part of the question, both Iraq and both Vietnam, the invasions of Vietnam and the invasion of Iraq were deliberate. All the documentation that's available now says that. The Pentagon Papers say that about Vietnam. These were deliberate strategies for a deliberate purpose. They were serious. They weren't some woolly mistake that someone made. We know that within a day or two of taking office in Rumsfeld, within a day or two of 9/11 happening, Rumsfeld wanted to attack Iraq, and the thrust of the administration's propaganda was that Iraq and al-Qaeda were the same. And perhaps there are some people who still think that's true, and it wasn't true. It was a lie, and it was a deliberate lie based on a deliberate strategy to attack Iraq for very understandable reasons. They wanted to control. They didn't want simply a rather tenuous base in Saudi Arabia in the Middle East. They wanted a whole country.
You know, I don't want to interrupt you on this point because I want to follow up, because one of the things you've written about quite a bit recently, John, has been Iran. And we haven't had much of a chance to talk about that. We've only got a few minutes left. And I was wondering if you would just sort of talk a little bit about where Iran fits into what's going on in Iraq now and what the concerns you see are for all of us with what's taking place in Iran today.
There is a deliberate campaign of disinformation in order to prepare the population of the United States and its institutions for an attack on Iran. Whether or not that attack takes place, we don't know. But there is a deliberate campaign of disinformation. Iran has tried over the last 5 years to strike compromises and deals with the United States. In 2003, it offered a whole swathe of proposals, including the suspension of its entirely legal nuclear program, non-weapons program, and all these were rejected. The International Atomic Energy Agency has denied time and again that Iran is working towards building a nuclear arsenal. And yet, look at the media in the United States and here it's deja vu, it's Iraq all over again. Here is the threat, when in fact the threat is not in Iran, or rather the threat of Iran is the fact that it's an independent country, and that's intolerable, of course. The threat is in the build-up of nuclear weapons programs in the United States, particularly the replacement program, which blurs the distinction between conventional war weapons and nuclear weapons. And the other threat is from Israel, which has an estimated 500 thermonuclear weapons targeted at various countries in the regions. Those are the threats. Those are the threats that ought to be addressed, not Iran.
Our guest, John Pilger, we've only got a couple of minutes left before we have to wrap up here at Media Matters. John Pilger, how long are you in the United States for?
I'm here until the 18th of June.
And then you're back to London, I assume, at that point?
I'm back in London. Yes.
How frequently do you come to the United States?
I suppose, pretty well every year. I was here last year briefly, yes. And
you've been coming here, I take it, then, really for decades.
I've been coming. My political education probably took its big leap forward here when I was based here in the late 1960s.
How has this country changed in the four decades since you first come here? I mean, it's interesting to get an outsider's view, sometimes a different perspective than those who are here all the time.
I think the opposition, the popular opposition to those vested interests that you described, seem to be quieter and perhaps feeling more beleaguered. But at the same time, this is frustrating because listening to your callers and, testing the temperature as one tries to do, there is this critical public intelligence that is well ahead of the media and always has been, in my view, in spite of often the contemptuous remarks heaped upon the public view in the media. And the fact that last November the majority of voters voted to get out of Iraq, it didn't happen, of course, but that's what they voted for, that's what they wanted. So I suppose I think the ordinary people are the same. They go about their lives decently. Power is very different, and power is concentrated in a way in this country that many of the much honored liberal freedoms have been eroded.
John Pilger, I hear the band tuning up in the background, which is a sign they want me out of the studio. I want to thank you very much for being our guest today in Media Matters. John Pilger is the filmmaker, maker of the recent film, The War on Democracy, also the author of numerous books, including Freedom Next Time. John will be in Chicago speaking on June 16th at the Crown Plaza Chicago here. Check him out there if you're in the area. And again, thank you very much, John Pilger, for joining us today.
Thank you, Bob. It's a pleasure.
And I'd like to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer. I'll be back with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Connie Schultz next week. See you then. Bye-bye.